It's Monday, March 10th, 2026. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. This is a conversation I was looking forward to having, and it worked even better than I thought it would. So I knew about what happened to Elizabeth Surkov for a while because my friend Ben Wittes of Lawfare hooked up with her sister, Emma, to try to free Elizabeth from a hostage situation in Iraq. She was kidnapped by an Iranian-backed militia, in fact, the most powerful Iranian-backed militia in Iraq, and there are a few, maybe there will be a few later these days, Kataib Hezbollah. She put herself on their radar by just being a Westerner. When they kidnapped Elizabeth, they knew that she was a Princeton PhD student. They did not know at the time that she was an Israeli national. She's also a Russian. She's not American, but her affiliation is Princeton, Israel, Russia. And of those three things, you know that Israel put her in the most dangerous situation. And in fact, she was beaten very badly. She was held for almost a year and a half. She was tortured. She wrote about this in The Atlantic in a story, a great story, because she's a smart person and a great writer who has studied these militias and Syrian citizens in the entire area. I Was Kidnapped by Idiots is the name of her Atlantic story. And in this conversation, you're going to get, and I want you to listen for a few things. I want you to listen for who she credits and who she gives no credit to of the different constituencies who had an opportunity to do something to save her in any way. And what's interesting is that Ben Wittes immediately, and Ben Wittes is as big a critic of Trump as you'll ever hear. He said, I will give the devil his due, or in this case, our president his due. Donald Trump's theory of the case and his philosophy and his strategy worked in a way that the Biden administration's did not. We get into that. You will also hear at some point that the audio gets odd, and that is because, well, I'll tell you why, but there is a reason for that when it happens, and it all relates to Elizabeth's harrowing ordeal. And then we get back to the fact I was talking to Elizabeth from Israel, and this conversation occurred before the war with Iran. But even being an Israeli national who has done nothing but exemplify what that country stands, much of what that country stands for, which is scholarship and being open to differing ideas, even that these days does not put you in good stead with some very powerful and important and influential, and to my mind, heretofore respected figures in Israel. I don't want to tease this conversation too much. It was one of the most meaningful I've had in a while. Elizabeth Surkov up next. Elizabeth Surkov was a PhD researcher affiliated with Princeton University in Baghdad when she was kidnapped by an Iraqi militia backed by Iran, Kataib Hezbollah. And for over 900 days, she was detained and tortured. But now she is out. The entire ordeal and story is fascinating. One of the best articles you'll ever read, with one of the best headlines, and we actually talk about it a little at the end, is I Was Kidnapped by Idiots, an academic field trip to Iraq, unexpectedly turned into an immersive field study on the ways authoritarian regimes use brutality. Indeed, it did. She learned a lot, and I think she's still recovering. Elizabeth joins me now. Thank you for being on The Gist.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Mike.
So we're going to, in this interview, I do want to establish, so everyone knows the stakes early on without re-traumatizing you, some of the details of the torture. And then we'll zoom back and talk about maybe things you didn't even know at the time about what was going on, what was informing these kidnappers. But let's, and I do apologize for this, so people understand, what were you put through by these idiots?
Yeah, so... And this is something that I mentioned in the article. And basically, you know, while these individuals are very, very ignorant and quite stupid, they are highly experienced at causing harm to other human beings, and they clearly also enjoy it. And basically, you know, I was kidnapped for a ransom as a foreigner. After they opened my phone, they realized that I'm Israeli. So then they insisted that I'm a spy. They generally think that foreigners in Iraq are spies. Whether you're a teacher or you're an engineer, you're there to spy, you know. So they basically believe that there are thousands of spies walking around Iraq at any given moment, you know. And basically, once they opened my phone, they started torturing me. And the torture is... it utilizes methods that are known in Iraq and are used in some other Middle Eastern countries. So that is, you know, why I'm kind of not sitting properly right now, because basically one of the modes of torture is you get handcuffed behind your back and then you're lifted with a hook through the handcuffs. And that caused my back to herniate. I have two herniated discs as a result of that. It puts immense pressure on the shoulders and the joints and the arm, you know, creates cuts along the wrists. But for me, the main problem was the back, because 8 days prior to my kidnapping, I went through an operation on my back in Baghdad to fix 3 herniated discs. And basically 2 of those got, were herniated again as a result of the torture. There was, sexual assault and harassment. They used electric shock on multiple occasions. Beatings to the face that caused me to lose a tooth, that caused me concussions, and just pain and like using the jaw basically and chewing. Really, after they herniated my back, they would put me in very uncomfortable positions due to the back being herniated. So they would see through cameras that were in my room that I would avoid certain positions. Like, for example, I would not bend to go to the toilet. So they would force me into that position because they knew that it would be painful. Or force me to just sit. Just sitting for me right now is torture, let alone right after they herniated the discs. There was also a mode of torture that is known in Iran as kapune. It is basically you get handcuffed behind your, with the shoulders crossed this way, and it causes immense pain in the shoulders.
And that is translated as the scorpion. This is what they call it.
Yeah, exactly. In Iraq, it's known as al akrab or scorpion, and it basically causes really immense pain. Like now, I recreated it for the video, and it's actually now very uncomfortable for me, because they really damaged my shoulders. Actually,
yeah.
But I forgot that and I did that move. But
great. Yeah, many people have said my interviews are torture. Now, literally, yes. I visit.
Literally,
sorry, I'm sorry. Fame. Okay, so as you said, they're extremely efficient at inflicting pain. But to what ends? They weren't, as you detail, at all efficient on using this pain to get any useful information, right?
Yeah, and actually, they're not unique in this regard. Torture is not, there have been multiple studies done about it. It produces basically false confessions, the confession that the torturer wants to hear because you just want the torture to stop. So let's, for example, say you are a murderer, but you're getting tortured to confess to being a thief. You will confess to being a thief, you know?
Yeah.
So basically, they insisted that I'm a spy and that I need to confess to it. And I, to stop the torture, would come up with these different stories, you know, to try and, you know, fit into their worldview. And it took me a while to learn the insane things that they believe in, to then match what I was confessing to their distorted view of reality. So, for example, they believe that the United States and Israel together created ISIS, right? So when I made up a confession initially that, you know, is kind of more grounded in reality, that they didn't, you know, that didn't pass, you know? So I needed to invent something that would make sense to them, that no, yes, the U.S. created ISIS and is sending people over, you know, from Syria to invade Iraq again, and all of this nonsense. So unfortunately, because I very purposefully avoided, while in Iraq, any interaction with people affiliated with militias, because it's dangerous, you know, and therefore I didn't have a good understanding of the alternative reality they live in. And so basically through months of beatings, I had to learn this, you know, like on the job, to like learn, okay, this doesn't make sense to them because they believe in this insane idea. So I need to match the confessions.
Right, right. So they were inflicting pain. You were giving them what they want. It was an exchange of information. It was, memes. This is what they call it. Just inform us, what was the nature of your PhD study, and how much did you know about this militia or these militias beforehand?
So I've researched Iraq for many years, but I never specialized in the militia. My knowledge about them was very much focused on their human rights abuses, because I would write reports concerning human rights in Iraq. So therefore, I didn't know about, their worldview, how each militia is, is divided into kind of subgroups and how they interact with one another. So my research, my academic research in Iraq focuses on the Sadrist movement. It is, the largest political movement in Iraq and actually in the Middle East. It has about 1 million members. It is led by Muqtada Sadr, a cleric who is... used to be the leader of Jaish al-Mahdi, Mahdi army, which carried out attacks against the U.S. forces, and is now basically, it used to be a political party within parliament and was the largest party in parliament, but then suddenly basically withdrew from parliament since 2021. And my research is in the field of political science. I'm seeking to understand through examining this case study and also a case study in Lebanon, why do people within political systems that are based on clientelism, basically buying votes through hiring people in the state or just giving them cash, why do some people, remain loyal to parties that are not delivering to them as much as they could from other parties? So it kind of contradicts that logic. So I basically did a lot of interviews with very simple kind of Shia supporters of this movement and of this cleric.
Yeah. And we should want that information, which will come up later. I mean, you are there for academic reasons, but the insights that you were trying to glean would help us as the United States, would certainly help the world understand this potent and dangerous, what was originally the Mahdi army, and that there are Iranian Shia Muslim Iranian affiliates who are extremely important and dangerous in Iraq. So you take a meeting what was the cover story, or what was the meeting that you thought you were taking that led to your kidnapping?
So it was a woman who reached out and said that she's a friend of a friend and asked me to help her with her research. And, Iraqis are very, very generous people. They've helped me a great deal doing my research. I had, three hernias in Iraq. I relied on people to literally carry me around. And I'm 6 foot tall. And they're tiny generally. So obviously compared to me, especially. So I just felt, I need to help her. Okay. Like, I don't have time for this. And it's hard for me to be sitting because it was 8 days after an operation, but Iraqis have been so nice to me. Let me go and meet her. And they made sure to have the meeting so close to my house that it wouldn't make any sense to take a taxi, so that I would be walking on foot and therefore it would be easy to grab me.
So how long did it take for you to discern which exact faction this is? And how did you learn, you mentioned this before, how did you learn what they wanted from you or what they thought they wanted from you?
So right away, I knew, like, after basically they started interrogating me, which I think was on the day after my kidnapping, it became clear to me that they didn't know that I'm also an Israeli national, in addition to my Russian nationality, and I entered on a Russian passport.
Right. So you're Russian, you have this Princeton affiliation, and also, of course, the very dangerous part is that you are also Israeli. So you knew to hide that from them. Yeah.
Exactly. And indeed, I had, everyone whom I met in Iraq, I would say I'm Russian, and I am Russian. And basically, when the interrogation started, I realized, oh, they don't know that I'm Israeli. So right away, it became apparent that they're just kidnapping for a ransom. It's not even anything, ideological or whatever, anti-Israel move. It's just to get money. I didn't know for quite a long time who was holding me. And it only became... 100% that it's indeed, Qatar Hezbollah once I came out. because first of all, I was, you know, I went through debriefings with Israeli intelligence and also with the FBI, which opened the case into my kidnapping, and have been, you know, utterly amazing and very, very dedicated working on this case while I was in captivity. And
both Israeli intelligence and the FBI, both
worked very hard. It's just that right. In the case of the FBI, I actually met the people who worked on my case, whereas in Israel, you know, they're like these super secret Mossad guys, so I never met them, you know. But the FBI, got to meet literally the people who were fighting for me, and it was, you know, incredibly emotional moment. They're just wonderful, dedicated people, mostly women, but also a few men worked on my case. So it was just, so first of all, they have all the information that proves that it was Qatad. But then even more, Qatad was very helpful. A month after they released me, they put up a statement on their Telegram channel. And there in a statement, they basically, because Qatad Hezbollah was very afraid that Israel or, you know, the U.S. will realize that they're the ones holding me. So they kept denying or kind of hiding the fact that they're holding me. So they put out the statement that, again, did not claim responsibility for my kidnapping, but said that, you know, that they broke up the network that I was running, and they didn't kidnap anyone because of me, because I, you know, made sure to invent confessions that would not implicate any, you know, innocent right. Iraqis, because I knew right. what this would mean. This is
right. There were red lines to a number of your confessions, not just people, but certain things that you knew not to admit, even though you were admitting all these fictions anyway.
Yeah, I was willing to basically say anything about myself, you know, including that I like sexually exploited officials like in Iraq to like get them to flip, like all sorts of like bullshit. Yeah. Just yeah. because this is what they believe, like, you know, female spies do. But I wouldn't, you know, implicate any innocent Iraqis, because I knew what this would mean to them, you know. So I would just say, no, I was working by myself, and they would torture me severely to get the names, and really put a lot of pressure on me. And really, I feel that, like, by the grace of God, when I thought that I'm really going to give in and just give names to just stop the pain, this is when the torture stopped, and they moved me to a different prison where there was no torture, basically, except, you know, being held in solitary and without a window for 25 months. Basically, a month after they put out the statement that said, you know, that they broke up this ring of people working for me, but very usefully, they also put the name of a Mossad CIA officer, because I confessed to being like a double spy.
Sure.
I guess like this salary in the agency is not enough. Like, you need two
right.
salaries.
But one is the good yeah. medical benefits, and the other is.
Exactly. So basically, they put up the name of this fake person that I created that only they would know, because they didn't release the name. And the name was actually a hint that I'm being tortured. The name is Ethan Nuima. Inuim in Hebrew is torture. So I invented it so that I assumed that they record like over 20 confession videos with me. I assumed they would be broadcast. They weren't. But I made up these several names of officers. It was Ethan Nuima, and it was Tori Tour, like torture, you know. And then there was Pete Kim, who is Putki in Russian, is also torture. So I was just thinking like, oh, this is going to get broadcast. This way, everyone's going to know I'm being tortured too, so that they rush to take me out. Later, it turned out the Israelis knew all along I'm getting tortured. They had intelligence information about it, but yeah.
Yeah, but except for that one name, did Tori Tor and the other breadcrumbs ever get gobbled up by anyone? Did they see the light of day?
They mentioned Ethan Nuima, basically, fake. So this was proof that they are the ones who held me, because it was never this information, this fake persona was never released otherwise. So that means they were the ones interrogating me.
Right.
So they're the kidnappers.
But even I would guess that even if Tori Tor and the other names didn't get out, just you using your intellect to resist probably was a benefit to you psychologically. It gave you some agency. You could strategize and weren't totally helpless in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that did get out is in November 23, an Iranian IRGC officer came to the second prison where I was held, and he recorded a confession video with me and also something related to the war in Gaza, and basically ordered me to repeat the confessions that I'd made and also say stuff about the war in Gaza. And he asked me to say that where I lived in Israel. So I claimed that I lived in a neighborhood called Gan HaChashmal in Tel Aviv, which is a real neighborhood, but I never lived in it. And obviously my family knows I never lived there. And it means electricity garden. So it was basically a way to hint that I'm being electrocuted, which I was. And my sister heard it and got it. And some people inside, you know, different security establishments also, because they also had information about the torture. So it was like, oh, they get it. They understand I'm being tortured with electricity. So this information did get out.
Wow. When they moved you to solitary, what was the explanation they gave? What did you tell yourself was the reason they must have been doing it? And now, after you learned the truth, what was the real reason?
So why did they move me? They never explained it. I think the move from that location to another location could be explained by some, you know, maybe they had concerns about the safety of the location, etc. And they wanted me to be closer to Iran because that the second facility was right on the border with Iran, so they could smuggle me into Iran at any moment that they wished. But it doesn't explain why they stopped torturing me, because the interrogation, they could have just, what happened is, you know, I confessed to a bunch of things under torture. And then they got so greedy, they would just come in, string me up by my wrists, you know, and start beating me and tell me, I want something new. I want something I haven't heard before. I want something new. Like, that's the quality of their interrogation. So they could have continued doing that forever. So why they stopped torturing me is unknown to me. And really, I attribute it to divine intervention.
So tell me about how you learned about and what they told you about the attacks of October 7th, because that was a fascinating geopolitically and psychologically.
That occurred 7 months after, no, 6.5 months after my kidnapping. Later in the year, at the very end of 23, in the second facility, they gave me a TV so I could follow the news. But at the time, during on October 7th itself, I didn't have a TV. So what I heard was from the guards' TV. They turned up the volume. They were right next to me, like behind the wall. And I heard what is being said. And it was in channels that are supportive of, you know, the Iranian access and resistance and all of this political sway.
Right.
And basically they were talking about prisoners. They were saying prisoners, not hostages, and soldiers. Like, a lot of times it would repeat, like in Arabic, like Asra and Junud. So I thought, okay, this sounds like, you know, like they invaded the military bases that surround Gaza, you know, and kidnapped some soldiers. And they were saying there are like 250 hostages, like prisoners, they call them. So I thought, oh, for sure they're lying, you know, because these types of channel, like, they make up things all the time.
Right.
But then the next day, there was a nurse who was allowed to come and visit me and talk to me. So, and he was very, very kind to me. He's the friend of the commander of the base where I was held. And he instructed him to take care of me because my medical situation was catastrophic, you know, when I arrived there after, you know, 4.5 months of starvation and torture and all sorts of medical issues, you know.
Right. I mean, he was kind, but you're an asset that maybe can earn a ransom. So that's informing the kindness.
Yeah. No, I think they definitely obviously wanted to keep me alive, but I think there was also genuine just, and this is actually something that is not unique to my case. This is something that happened with multiple hostages in Gaza, that there were some, you know, people who were utter beasts, and then some would like sneak food and help them survive and not starve to death, you know? So yeah, you find, you know, kindness even in very, you know, very strange places. It does exist. So he told me, like, yeah, there are all these, like, the number of hostages, the number of killed is real, like what you overheard on TV, you know, like 1,200 killed. And they were, like, my guards were ecstatic about it. They were so happy. They, on that day, on October 7th, one of the channels that they were, you know, that they were watching played this song by Lebanese pro-Hezbollah singer, And it goes, San Salif al-Quds, we will pray in Jerusalem. And it's a song from the 2000s, like, you know, we will destroy the Zionists, we will pray in Jerusalem, liberation is near, etc. So they play it on this day. And one of the guards was so happy, he was stomping on the floor, you know, like, ah, yes, 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 this is happening, you know? You know, they really didn't understand, and neither did Hamas, obviously, what is going to happen next. They thought that this is just this amazing victory. Now Israel is going to, because there are hostages in Gaza, it is going to release all the prisoners that it holds, you know, people who have murdered, you know, thousands of Israelis collectively, that they will let them go and just not attack Gaza because there are 250 hostages inside. Like, they completely don't understand the government that is in Israel and also the desire for vengeance that, you know, emerges after you slaughter, you know, entire families, you know, in their homes.
We'll be back in a minute with more with Elizabeth Tsirkov. We're back with Elizabeth Tsirkov, who is the author of I Was Kidnapped by Idiots Because She Was, talking more about her ordeal.
It's a really interesting insight because when Hamas executed its attack, I think the best knowledge is that the other Iranian proxies, including Hezbollah in Lebanon and your version of Hezbollah, they didn't know, but Hamas's strategy was to inspire them into, you know, a worldwide or region-wide further action. So this shows that at least one proxy force really did not know, that they actually were at least very excited. But then, as the war progressed, what was their attitude?
Right. So there, no, they definitely didn't know. And if we think about it, right, we later saw the wars that occurred against Lebanon and Iran, right? And they demonstrated complete intelligence penetration by the Israelis. So,
yes.
So actually, if the date had been known to the Iranians or Hezbollah, it would have been known to Israel as well. And the attack wouldn't have happened, right? Israel would have stopped it. But they genuinely didn't know. The Iran obviously financed the attack. The IRGC provided $500 million to Hamas for this attack. They discussed the general outline, but they didn't know the date. And Sinwar purposefully hid it from them. Like, they didn't know. And therefore were not prepared to act immediately, you know?
Right.
And this was amazing luck for Israel because, you know, in theory, if Hezbollah had known about it, but it didn't become known to Israel, somehow it would have eluded detection. This would have meant that, you know, a much stronger force would cross into northern Israel with much more advanced weaponry and cause slaughter and kidnap way more people, you know. So But basically their sense initially that this was amazing, that they are really on the verge of, you know, succeeding. They're on the verge of really destroying the state of Israel. Then gradually, as time went on, they realized that they're not, that this is not going to happen, you know, and but still expected the overall war to be successful and that their effort to, you know, harass Israel and send drones and the Houthis firing missiles and Hezbollah, that all of this would basically lead Israel to end the war and capitulate.
Right. And then they grew despondent as that became clear that that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, indeed. And I think really kind of they were increasingly despondent, confused. Why is the war not ending? Especially if you look at channels that support, like, that's the stuff that they would watch, you know, channels that support this axis of resistance, especially Al Jazeera, which is run by out of Qatar and is financed from Qatar. Analysts there, and I would watch the channel as well in captivity, analysts there were constantly saying, you know, the resistance is so effective, Israel, all the soldiers are getting killed, Israel is hiding casualties, the soldiers who are not getting killed are killing themselves because they're so depressed. You know, the victory is upon us. The economy is collapsing. Everything is terrible, you know? And this is just not happening. So they were very, very confused. And then there was the day of the pager attack in Lebanon. And that was the day when they really like gawked at me. Like they were clearly terrified. Like, what is this? Like it just, it demonstrated just how penetrated this access is. And also it's so humiliating, you know, because they purchased this. These are tracking devices that are also explosive, and they paid the Mossad to buy it. Like this is just, so that was really, from there it just went downhill. You know, then there was the war in Hezbollah, Nasrallah is assassinated, who was really the most popular symbol of the axis of resistance until, or, you know, the Iranian axis until he was killed. My guards would watch his speeches, you know, very excitedly. For example, they wouldn't watch speeches like Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran. He's, you know, an 86-year-old guy who speaks, he's not charismatic in any way, speaks very slowly, whereas Nasrallah is really, was this charismatic figure. So to them, his loss was something that is just, that was utterly heartbreaking.
Right. So a couple things. I just want to tell my audience that you heard a difference in audio quality. Elizabeth has to pace and walk because of what she said, her herniated disc. She's still in a lot of pain, and sitting down for any sort of extended period of time is just not doable. So please stay with us as you hear. It's a fascinating interview. The other thing that I wanted to say or note was Elizabeth was a Netanyahu opponent and protested against him. So when you hear her talk about the effectiveness of some of these strikes, just know where she was coming from, situating her in the domestic politics of Israel. And the third thing is my observation, which is when an entity or Hezbollah and Iran so dominate a media ecosystem that only disinformation comes through, we often think, well, that's a benefit to the people who are controlling the information. You can convince publics of just about anything. But the downside, as we're hearing, is even the entities that are controlling the media ecosystem are also lying to themselves, and therefore they can become surprised. And so it can, in fact, be a tactical disadvantage. I wanted to get to, and if you want to talk about any of that, you can, but I wanted to get to, because this is really interesting, they made you write reports. They turned you into some sort of, I guess, quasi-academic, or maybe if they thought you were a CIA officer, you'd have to be issuing briefings. What was the purpose of those reports, and how did you approach them?
So right after I was moved to the second facility, they told me to write out all my confessions in written form. And that was like over 100 pages, because I spent, you know, basically, you know, since the moment the torture started, I started just, you know, for 3.5 months, I was making shit up that then needed to be written down. And they asked me for all sorts of additional questions, like analytical questions, like what's the difference between the CIA and Mossad, like in terms of like their cultural, like organizational culture. So I just made stuff up that I thought made sense. Like I wasn't, you know, obviously I don't have actual information, but I, you know, just speculated about how different it would be. So there were several more kind of analytical elements right away. And then after they gave me the TV, I started watching it. And I'm watching the channels that, you know, these guys are also watching, particularly Al Jazeera and also Al Mayadeen, which is a Lebanese Hezbollah, pro-Hezbollah channel. And they're just lying to their viewers. They're telling them the war is going to be over. And, you know, for me as an Israeli, as an analyst, I understand the political interests at play, and that Netanyahu has no interest in ending the war anytime soon, because that would, you know, damage his ability to stay in power, because his two coalition partners on the far right want the war to continue forever to then, you know, ethnically cleanse Gaza and establish settlements there. So it was, and in addition, he has the trial. He wants people to forget as much as possible October 7th. So he just wants to drag it on. And at the same time, this was during the Biden administration still, there was no pressure on Israel to end the war, you know? So one time the nurse came over and I was watching Al Jazeera and I was telling him, like, this is nonsense. This war is going to last for a long time, you know? This is not going to end anytime soon. What these analysts are saying is nonsense. And he told me, like, could you please write about it? So I wrote about it. And this is how it started. Basically, we would often discuss politics when he would come and visit me. And then he started coming with requests of papers that he got from higher ups that they want me to write about. So, for example, they asked me to write about how do I think, for example, this was after the war in Hezbollah. How do I think that Hezbollah got penetrated, you know? And based on media reports that were appearing in the different channels that I was watching, obviously I didn't have internet, there were all sorts of indications of how this penetration happened. And in addition to that, I do have, you know, I have read books. And during my obligatory military service in Israel, I served in the Directorate of Intelligence. So I don't have any relevant information. This was, you know, 20 years ago. But, you know, I do have some understanding of how this world works, you know. So I would write these reports to them. Then gradually, you know, as time went by and it was clear to me that they told me that they're negotiating. So it was clear to me that the interrogation phase ended and that they're probably not going to start torturing me again. I started basically including more and more elements into these pieces that was utterly like genuine assessment. Much of it is basically, you know, pointing out how corrupt the factions are, how weak they are, how pathetic they are, how
You asked, right? Yeah, exactly, you asked. Exactly. This is the honest assessment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and I know that one of the people who was reading it was very unhappy. Like, how dare she? Why is she writing it this way? Like, this is unacceptable. But, you know, they didn't come and like start beating me over it. So I just kept writing in this way. And actually, I got like really kind of outrageously cheeky towards the end because I'm like, okay, they're clearly just tolerating it, you know, because they do want the information that comes in and the analysis. And they did appreciate the analysis. Like, the senior commander in the base, said that this is good analysis and much better than what we have, you know, because their analysts consistently get everything wrong because they're, you know, first of all, they're quite ignorant about Israel, but also they're ideologically motivated to say everything we're doing is correct. So therefore, they're predicting that reality will align with their ideology, and it just doesn't.
When you were detained and being kidnapped, what did you tell yourself to keep going? Psychologically, were there very low moments? There must have been. And what pulled you out of them?
Well, I mean, first of all, like the first 4.5 months were utterly terrible and very, very destructive to the mind. It's very important for me not to, speaking to you and I seem, you know, okay. It's very important for me to stress that this is in to large extent because of the time that passed from the period when the physical horrific torture ended. Because my mind at that stage, in the first place, I wouldn't have given any interviews if I had just been, you know, released from that prison, because I was just like not in a position to give any interviews, not in a position to hold a normal conversation. I was very, very, very distressed. What helped me during that phase was, you know, I would feel that, I felt that I'm going to lose my mind. And I also felt that even if I don't lose my mind, that, you know, these beasts have implanted in my mind such, you know, horrible memories that I would never be able to rid myself of them. And therefore, I would never be happy, you know, and what's the point of living such a life, you know? Now, in that part of captivity, I was also, you know, I wanted to stop feeling the pain and I was terrified that I would implicate others. So I stayed alive kind of because I had no option of not staying alive. Like, they made sure that this is not a prison in which you could kill yourself. I was really, really terrified that I would, that under pressure, I would implicate other people. And my life is not worthier than their lives, obviously. And it's not just one person. They would kidnap them. They would torture them. They would then implicate multiple other people. So I was utterly terrified by that. What helped me then is I thought a lot about two very close friends of mine who are both Syrian and have both survived really, really horrific torture, way worse than I did. And I know them. We're very close and they love me. And, you know, I was also very numb emotionally, you know, like a coping strategy. I just felt nothing, you know. I didn't feel fear. I didn't feel love. I didn't miss my family. I was just And I was afraid that I would just stay this way, like a zombie, you know, what's the point of living such a life, you know? But I knew that they are loving people. I also know that they're funny and productive, you know, people, both are researchers. So thinking about them really, really helped me. Like I felt that they were there, with me in the cell with me. And, you know, they would lift my spirit, you know, thinking about them and thinking about, you know, if they managed to pull through something even more horrific than what I'm going through, then I'll be able to pull through, you know?
Yeah. So that really have you helped. Seen them since?
I've spoken to both by video, but I'm hoping to meet one of them soon in Europe. You know, unless a war breaks out with Iran and all flights are canceled, I'm hoping to see him next month.
Elizabeth Tsirkov is now senior non-resident fellow at the New Lines Institute. Where are you on the PhD research?
I'm writing the dissertation now, yeah.
Wow. That'll be, I hope that passes peer review. Thank you so much. Good luck with everything. And really, thanks for your insight, your time, your great article in The Atlantic, and talking to me today. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
And that's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. Jeff Craig runs our socials. Ben Astaire is our production coordinator. Kathleen Sykes helps me with the Gist list, kind of more than helps me. MikePesca.substack.com is where to sign up for that. And Michelle Pesca runs it all. Not an idiot. She kidnapped me with her heart. Oompru-jee-pru-doo-pru, and thanks for listening.